Are you enjoying this podcast? Well, you have KUOW members to thank for that. KUOW members make the trusted local journalism and storytelling you hear on this show possible. Become a member today and help support the production of this podcast. It only takes a minute. Make a donation at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. What is the future of downtown Seattle? We're going to discuss that with my panel here. And by panel, I mean the president and CEO of the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, Rachel Smith. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm great to be here.
We have the co-host of the Too Beautiful to Live podcast, Andrew Walsh. Hiya, Andrew.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. And author and speaker, Jodi Ann Bury. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Good to see you. Good to see all of you. And you can see us because we're streaming the show on YouTube. Just search KUOW Public Radio. Okay, topic number one. Rachel from the Chamber. I keep reading about the, quote, urban doom loop. Is this a phrase you're familiar with?
It is a phrase I'm familiar with. And I think the New York Times tells us that talking about a doom loop can actually create the doom loop.
Oh, no.
So I'm not sure we should be talking about this at all.
Well, let's get to the Cougars.
Okay, well, let's just call it UDL so no one knows what we're talking about.
UDL.
So this refers to a downward spiral where workers don't go, they don't return, the offices are vacant, retail is shutting down, people feel less comfortable and safe, real estate prices drop, city loses tax revenue, they reduce services, so that's that much less reason to live and work downtown. Is Seattle... I'm guessing you don't think it's in a UDL. Are we on the rebound? Where are we at?
Shocking. Your Seattle Metro Chamber leader does not think we are, in fact, in a doom loop.
Okay, we made news.
Yes, you've made news. Cheerleader in chief over here. Okay. So, no, I do not think we are. I think Seattle has so many bright spots going for it right now, particularly downtown. And I think we are, you know, if we're playing a game of Monopoly, we've passed go and collected 200. Now, how we play the board, how urgently we address the issues, how quickly we seize opportunities, that's still up to us. But I absolutely think that we are on the upswing. And, you know, for me, as I think about the positive things that we have going, you know, one is our assets, our music venues, our arts museums, our sports stadiums, the waterfront. I just joined the aquarium board and the new pavilion that's going to be opening. We have more people living downtown than ever before. And that is, I think, really a testament to intentionally making downtown a neighborhood. We had 6.5 million visitors last summer, whether they were on cruise ships or going to Taylor Swift or Mariners games or whatever. Huge tourism numbers. And we're seeing people go back to the office. So that is happening. We recently did a study and more people are back more frequently than you think. And we've, for downtown, the data hovers somewhere between 50 to 60% of office workers back compared to pre-pandemic. So to me, those are all positive signs, all going in the right direction.
Any reaction to that upswing that you just heard described?
I love me a good downtown. I like density. I like making sure that things are walkable. I love, you know, I feel like I'm constantly battling the quote unquote Seattle is dying argument. I'm not from here originally, but I have family like in Ohio and, you know, around the country. I'm telling you, I talked to my uncle for the first time in a long time the other day, and he asked me if I'm rioting. And I'm trying to tell people like, no, that's not what Seattle is like. Seattle, I'm also a cheerleader for the city. I love this city. And I'm glad to see it sort of continue to evolve. I think the one sort of sticking point that I've been seeing as I've been sort of listening to the coverage is this idea of sort of like our city leaders trying to sort of force, or let's just say maybe more gently, encourage businesses to then force their employees to come into the office. Mm-hmm. And to me, that seems a little bit wagging of the dog. It sort of seems to me like cities should serve people. People shouldn't serve cities. And so we're in this place now. The pandemic obviously sped it up a bit, but like technology changes sort of society. We know that. And so we continue to evolve as people and as workers and as business owners. And so it sort of seems like if we are sort of evolving past this idea of people having to be in a physical place, we shouldn't force that just for tax revenue or whatever. We should find new creative ways to get people downtown.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. You know, I feel like every time I talk, I bring up cancer, but you know, I have a public health master's and I've gone through cancer experiences, so I often rely on that for analogies. But anytime when you go through a wholly traumatic experience, there's a conversation about establishing a new normal, that you have to interrogate this idea of quote unquote going back, right? And so the person who I was before my experience, I cannot go back to that version of myself, but I can create a new normal of who I am. And so I see that underneath this argument of like, okay, are we going back to downtown as usual, or is this an opportunity to establish a new normal, a greater imagination for what downtowns can be? I would love to see downtown as a neighborhood. I would love to see us rethink, you know, our over-reliance and hyper-dependence on business tax revenue, right? You know, Seattle does not have a diverse business portfolio, right? We're very heavily invested in tech, and tech workers right now, or tech office workers, are feeling the brunt and the strain of really juvenile mandates of returning to the office, and that squeezes, you know, the culture of the city overall, right? Our families, our interactions. And so I think that this idea of urban doom, the urban doom loop, you know, maybe gets worse before it gets better. But I don't think that the doom is inevitable. I think that what's happened with the pandemic and this kind of quote unquote post-pandemic period is really a call for us to imagine anew.
Okay, Rachel, we settled on the one theme I want to pick out of both of those comments is this idea of calling people back to the office. And you heard both Andrew and Jodi Ann saying that calls like that are dragging us backward into an old way, that whether it even arguably whether it worked or not then, it's not the future.
I totally agree that we need a new normal, and I also agree that we need to think about downtowns differently, and they need to be more inclusive, and they need to invite more people to do more things in different ways than they ever have. So I agree with that completely. And I think that flexibility is key to that. And I think you see employers embracing flexibility a great deal. But I think people do need to go back to the office. I think, again, it needs to look differently and it needs to be flexible. So I don't think that it's necessarily going to look like it did pre-pandemic. But I think humans are essential elements of vibrancy, of innovation, of creativity. And I think they do need to do that in person. I also think that when you look at the numbers of people to keep downtown vibrant, like, yes, we have over 100,000 people now living downtown, but we had over 350,000 people coming every day to downtown before to work. You simply can't replace 350,000 people with just one other thing. So it needs to be a whole lot of things. I also think that we do have a fairly diverse economy when you look across the region. And I think there's some ways to bring some of that economic activity into downtown alongside with the economic activity that's already there. And I want to just plus one, the Seattle is not dying. My line here is like, Seattle is not dying. Like, yes, we have problems, but our promise far outweighs it. And I stand behind that.
Can you talk to my uncle?
Sure, happy to.
I'm going to give you
happy
his number.
To. Yeah, yeah.
She's busy rioting.
Yeah, sorry. When I finish rioting, yes.
No. Well, you know, what I'll say to that, too, is that, you know, that flexibility is not just about hybrid work. We can have flexibility in terms of what happens with commercial spaces or office spaces.
Yes.
You know, I would love to see, you know, you have one company that maybe owns 10 floors of a building. Well, maybe that could be the space for not just one company, 10 floors, but maybe 10 companies, right? Or 30 companies that are creating, you know, micro spaces where, you know, entrepreneurs and business owners could have access to live and work in downtown spaces, you know. And beyond that, though, I do think that it's important to note that humans are not only vibrant when we are working. And so I want us to think beyond like our, you know, economic capital in terms of like ways that we work, but there are other ways that we can connect. You know, yes, Seattle, we do need to connect with other people, right? The ways that we connect in third spaces is really important to the health of a city, including and beyond downtown spaces.
Yeah, and just from my perspective, like, I'm not against, you know, going into the office if that is what, you know, somebody who owns a company, whatever it may be, if the leadership there says, hey, listen, we are more productive if our employees come in, I think that's totally up to that business owner to do that and for everybody to make their own decisions. I guess I get caught up in that seems sort of like a big part of Seattle leadership's plan right now is to sort of compel people, like through incentivizing business owners who then can compel their employees to come back because, again, we need people. It sort of seems like, well, cities evolved in a way because people were drawn there naturally, magnetically, because of waterways and transportation, and that's why population centers like sort of, you know, popped up in the first place. I was sort of thinking, if I have time for an analogy here, I've been working on it all morning.
Okay.
So if you'll give me the space here for one
Everybody
moment.
Everybody back up.
It's so bad. But here's what I was thinking. I was like, I don't bring up buggy whips. You're old enough. Don't bring up the buggy whip analogy. But I was telling you guys before the show that I've had a beard almost my entire adult life, right? Mm-hmm. And probably because I was too nervous to come on your show, Bill, this morning or late last night, I accidentally... while trimming my beard, shaved a big bald spot in my face. Mm. And I'm like, now how do I handle this? And I figured I had several options here, right? I could just come in here with a big bald spot on my face, and you guys would all be kind enough probably not to say anything.
Right.
But I've never met you guys in person before. It seemed like I didn't want to do that. I could totally shave my entire face, go back to that. I call my beard my face hider because I don't like my face. I didn't love that.
Oh.
I decided sort of a middle ground. I kept a mustache here. And then I sort of thought, if I called the city council, what would they tell me to do? And I sort of thought they might tell me to scoop up all the hair and glue it back onto my face. Because that's where the hair started, and that is not the right solution here. Like, maybe downtown Seattle can be a mustache city for a little bit until we can grow our beard back. But I just think that we have to sort of evolve and adapt to the situation, not just kind of look backwards.
So I'm going to talk to Visit Seattle and tell them we're definitely not calling us the mustache city.
Just so we're
on the same page. I will not be advocating for that new.
I'll win you over.
One thing I want to make sure that we talk about here, like, yes, we are compelling workers to go back, but that compelling and quote unquote encouragement is punitive, right? They are telling people, I have seen that if you do not come to the office, you will not be promoted, right? You will not be, you might not even work here anymore. And those types of measures really walks back a lot of the gains that we've had within this office remote working experience, right? We've seen increased participation of disabled workers being able to join the workforce. You know, there are a lot of Black and Brown women who are mentally, physically, and emotionally well because they're not dealing with the barrage of microaggressions that they face in office spaces. And so I just want to make sure that, like, yes, we're joking about it and that's cool, but a lot of the ways that a lot of these companies are functioning is that they are being punitive in their mandates to come back, and that impacts our equity initiatives.
I want to just say I don't know that I totally agree with that. I think you absolutely can have equitable policies within your organization or your company and have an equitable back to office and flexibility in terms of virtual and in person. So I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
I mean, you could.
Yeah.
Is that happening?
I think it is in a lot of our member companies. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're telling people that if they work remotely, that they won't be promoted, how is that equitable?
I haven't had any of our members tell people that they're not going to be promoted if they don't.
Yeah. But it doesn't mean it's not happening. And so I just want to emphasize that there is an equity issue here as well when we're talking about office workers being able to be hybrid or fully remote and their opportunities to be in the workforce.
Well, when we're talking about the health of downtown, that's where, for a lot of reasons, that's where our attention goes. That is, as you have said, the economic engine of the region. But does it always have to be that way? It's certainly where the skyscrapers are and the big parking garages and the tourists. KUOW has an economy podcast called Booming. And the very latest episode is about the goal of a 15-minute city. Mm-hmm. You've heard of that?
Of course.
This idea of that most of your needs are within a 15-minute walk or bike ride. So you've got in your neighborhood a grocery store and other retail needs and jobs and schools and healthcare and parks and transit. Is that also what you're the Metro Chamber? You're not the Downtown Seattle Association.
Right.
Is that what the chamber wants, or does that keep people? Does that make neighborhoods more self-sufficient? And would that sap downtown? How do you think about that?
I think it's just an all of the above approach, 100%. I mean, downtown already is a 15-minute city, right? Downtown is already a 15-minute neighborhood.
The drugstores are disappearing. The PCC is
which
closing.
Is problematic, yeah. And we can talk more about those things. But I think sticking with that theme, you can't replace the economic activity that you have in downtown in any one particular neighborhood. And we shouldn't try. We should have a vibrant and thriving downtown. And we should have a 15-minute city. And I think when we talk about a 15-minute city, to me, what we're talking about is density. We're talking about access to transportation choices. We're talking about, neighborhood commercial. And we are fully supportive of all of those things at the Chamber. And not just in Seattle, but in, cities around the region. So I reject the notion that we should have downtown or neighborhoods. It is downtown and neighborhoods, and we absolutely need both.
I've got three heads nodding.
So yeah,
good.
A lot of agreement.
I mean, I think we all want a vibrant city, right? We all want a density. We all want a walkable and a transportation or a city with good public transportation options. Rachel, I am just kind of curious because, I've pushed back a little bit about the idea of working, compelling people to come back to the city just to work. Aside from that, just tabling that, what other ideas from your members and you and your staff, what other things aside from the work initiatives do you see bringing people back to downtown?
Yeah, I could talk a long time about this. So you just cut me off whenever you're ready. But, I think there is, again, going back to all of those assets that we have. So there's opportunities for entertainment and recreation, shopping, retail, places like the Pike Place Market, whether you're going there for a tourist activity or you're actually just going there to, buy produce. So I think downtown has all of that and we should be encouraging more of those things. I also think that, this is an opportunity to also think differently about some of the buildings that we have and the uses that are allowed in those buildings. So thinking about things like healthcare and education, life sciences, are there ways that we can modify some of the existing buildings that we have to increase more business activity, but different kinds of business activity? The Office of Economic Development has a very cool program called Seattle Restored, where small businesses are coming into vacant storefronts and being given an opportunity through some subsidy and support to see if they can kind of make a go of a brick and mortar, which is very cool. So I think it is. Like many things, it is all of the above. I think we need more workers going back into the office, and I say that unequivocally. I think we want more people living downtown, even though we've got record numbers. I think we want to juice up those entertainment opportunities and then take advantage of the newer assets that we had. We just had the convention center expansion open. Again, we've got the aquarium, the waterfront. So I think we can market downtown in all of the above ways to encourage people to come down. And neighborhoods can do many versions of that as well, which is great.
Yeah. I'm very anti-return to work. So I think to make that clear, return to the office.
We're clear.
Yeah. Okay, in case you didn't know, that's how I feel about that.
You didn't even want to come here today.
Truly. But what I will say, I live a 15-minute city life now. I live in Wallingford. I live close to the main drag. I walk, to get most of my needs met. I often walk my dog and can bring him into the Walgreens and bring him into the Chase and do my activities that way. My dentist is downstairs from my building. And so all of that is super, super cool. But I will say also Wallingford is very, 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 very white. Right. And so I have to leave Wallingford for even basic things like to sit at a coffee shop where I can see other Black people. And so part of a healthy 15-minute city also means diversifying historically white areas, stopping the effects of gentrification, lowering housing costs that can bring more people in contact with each other of different backgrounds and different ethnicities and different literal walks of life, so we can kind of, commune together. And I think, I absolutely agree. Downtown is not the be all end all. And so I would love to see that kind of 15-minute concept in all of the neighborhoods.
And can I add one? So I totally agree with all of that. And I think there's an opportunity in front of us right now, which is with the comprehensive plan that cities are taking up around the region. And, for us, our priorities are how can we get more units, more density in more parts of the city? How can we have more commercial opportunities in neighborhoods and doing all of that, as Jodi-Ann just said, with an eye towards equity and affordability? So
So if you're not tracking the very wonky comp plan at the city, but you're into what we're saying here, I think there's a real opportunity for you.
Okay, well, the comprehensive plan has to do with density. We've brought up density, and we've brought up housing costs. And I also want to ask about the role of police. So why don't we take a short break and get back to our Which Way Seattle conversation, okay? On Week in Review, I'm Bill Radke. You're listening there to author and speaker Jodi Ann Bury, co-host of the Too Beautiful to Live podcast, the mustachioed, and that's all, Andrew Walsh, the president and CEO of the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, Rachel Smith, and we'll all be right back.
This podcast is free, and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks!
If you are doing that, I'm waving at you right now because we're on YouTube. Just search KUOW. Thank you, everyone. Four waivers. We've got waivers today. We've got Jodi Ann Bury. We've got Andrew Walsh from Too Beautiful to Live. We've got the Chamber's Rachel Smith. And we are talking about Which Way Seattle. And let me just say a couple more things about, since we brought up density in the comprehensive plan. The comprehensive plan is something that the city updates every 10 years. It's the vision for growing for the next two decades. And the mayor's plan calls for some upzoning, but not as much as urbanists were calling for. The mayor said it allows for at least 100,000 new homes. We had Publicola's Erica Barnett on the show saying, yeah, if they had done nothing at all, it would have allowed for 80,000. It's kind of the minimum. It would allow, so right now you can have three units in the neighborhoods, and this would allow some four-unit buildings, which is in accordance with a new state law. A little more if they're affordable, a little more if you're near transit. There's a question about whether developers are really interested in building four-unit buildings. So those are some of the density questions swirling around. So where do we want to start on the topic of densifying Seattle? We know there's a lot of opposition to this, and everyone can talk about, well, we got to grow, we got to get denser, but we're not necessarily changing as fast as everybody wants us to.
I can throw in a few statistics that are hot off the presses that we have, some voter polling that we have at the Seattle Metro Chamber. So we asked a question, and this is going to be released in the next couple of weeks. This is the index, which is our public opinion research that we do twice a year. So when asked, all things considered, growth and development has been a positive for my area. 58% of people, so nearly 6 in 10, agree with that statement, and 41 disagree. That's actually up 5 points from October. So, 6 in 10 are saying overall that's a good thing. We changed one of the questions that we had traditionally asked from I support the building of new housing in my neighborhood to I support the building of a wider variety of housing in my neighborhood. Nearly 7 in 10 voters agree with that statement, which I think speaks a lot to openness to density and more people in their communities and the vibrancy that it brings. And then 60% of voters agree that we, quote, we should allow the construction of more retail and commercial spaces in my neighborhood. So I think if we just want to say, where are the people? The people are for some increased density, more commercial. And I think we also know from our polling that affordability and affordable housing in particular is one of the top three concerns. So we didn't have to ask that, I think, in relation to the comp plan, because we know it's a top concern. And that actually went up in this index that we'll be releasing in the next couple of weeks as well. So sort of setting the groundwork for the conversation, I think the voters are like, yes.
Okay, I do want to hear from my other panelists. One more data, I don't know if it's a data point or not, but the plan envisioned two dozen denser neighborhood centers. But the reaction from, again, the urbanist community that I'm looking at said, what about Alki Beach and Fauntleroy and North Capitol Hill and Magnolia and Laurelhurst and Seward Park? So that it didn't seem like not all the neighborhoods were on board sounding as your painting. You're saying Seattle, there's more willingness than maybe we we realize in Seattle for more, even more upzoning and density.
That is what I'm saying.
Any reaction?
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just, I mean, I don't really have a reaction other than kind of more questions about it, which is really more your role here, Bill. Sorry, I keep asking questions. But I'm wondering where we're seeing the impetus for that change, or the reason for that change in the polling. Is it because people have seen some density in their neighborhoods and they were reluctant at first, but now they're less scared because they're seeing it? Is it a generational thing? Is it because we're seeing more people coming from outside the region and moving here the way I did in 2009, and therefore, like, maybe people like me or more transplants are more open to density than the long time, you know, Seattle residents who've lived in a bit of a walled garden for a while? Does anybody have any thoughts on that? Sorry, Bill. I don't know why I'm trying to host this thing.
I'm just admiring. I'm marveling at a job well done.
I love those questions. I live in Wallingford, which is known for a lot of the craft houses. And at least what I've heard, word on the street. I mean, no one's talking to me. They talk to my dog. But things that I've heard about Wallingford folks is that they want to make Wallingford a historic district, or, you know, they're very anti-density, right? Building a lot more apartment buildings or, you know, multi-unit dwellings. And so I have questions, too, about, like, around which areas can we make more dense. Also want to know who's responding to these polls. Ain't nobody asked me what I think about this. And so are there any, like the demographics, the people who answer the polls, is that skewing the data in any type of way? And should we be excited about 6 out of 10? You know, you can't pass a test on 60%. That is not passing, right?
Well, I'll jump in on a couple of things there. We actually do break it down. So first of all, it's all registered voters. So it's not just a community-based poll. It is just registered voters. But it's also not like likely November voters. So it's not just sort of a political polling. It is all registered voters, which gives us a broader demographic. And we do look at it based on age, based on race, based on gender, based on how long you've lived in the city, based on if you're a homeowner or renter. And I think the thing that you see in this data is, and it's fascinating to me, there's those stark differences that you might expect to see between renters and homeowners, or between young people and older people, or between people who have lived here for only a couple of years or been here over 20 years. Those differences are not really there from a material perspective. There's a lot more alignment with the voters than I think people think. And sure, I totally agree with my fellow panelists here. The devil gets in the details when you're talking about, you know, in your particular neighborhood next door to your house or whatever. But I think if we are if our legislators are legislating to the majority of the city, they ought to be legislating in this direction, because that's what the majority of registered voters have to say.
Yeah. Well, we know Andrew is excellent at asking questions.
You want to take this one, Bill?
Yeah, I'll take it. Just this time, because Andrew asked such a good question about what what the chamber is looking for. And you listed a lot of opportunities and yes and more of this and that. But I didn't hear anything about policing, and I'd like to know what the chamber wants police to do differently, if anything.
Yeah, so going to be a little bit of a broken record here, but we are in all of the above approach to policing as well. So we want to see more officers and the right number of officers to meet response times. We want alternatives in the department or outside of the department. CARE being a really good example of that, which I suspect we'll talk a little bit about. And
CARE
then
is the Community Assisted Response and Engagement Department. This is a new response that sends civilian teams, including behavioral health providers, alongside SPD officers. Though, again, there are plenty of advocates who would like just for mental health crisis calls to be answered only by mental health professionals and social workers without guns involved. But it was more of a yes-and approach with the CARE team.
Yeah, and I think the statistic, you'd have to check me on this, but from the city, is that they've done over 200 calls without police. So I think they are doing both. And then the third thing is reforms within the department, in particular around, you know, sort of anti-racism reforms. And we all know that there's a contract negotiation happening with the Police Officers Guild right now. So we really believe in all three of those things and advocate strongly in support of all three of them.
Jodi Ann, we've talked a little bit about this before on the show. If not, so I'll sort of try to set you up. If not police, what is your vision for, crime deterrence and punishment? Or do you want to back up and tell us about, more general reaction to the idea of a yes and policing approach?
I'll just say this. I feel like the mayor, like many liberal Seattleites, bought all the books in 2020 but did not read them.
He was propping up his laptop on Zoom with the books.
Yes. But wasn't sure. Okay. Or ordering them and then, leaving them at the bookstore. But I feel like the fact that, we're not having a more aggressive, urgent approach as some other progressive cities to just having, the care teams or mental health professionals respond, reducing police in Seattle. I feel just there's like the all above approach gives a lot of mixed messaging. The last time I was here, we talked about the mayor really advocating for a shot spotter, which is a technology that does not work. To my understanding, they extended the opportunities for public comment, which closes today, March 22nd. And so I just want us to think beyond police and make those responses a little bit more urgent. And so, like I said at the top of the show, I studied public health. That's the discipline that I come from. And so when we think about violence and public safety, that is a public health issue, right? And so we can think about it through or violence deterrence or crime deterrence through that public health perspective. And so that would mean looking at income inequity, right? Like even things like we're talking about the 15-minute city, allowing people to build relationships within their own neighborhood, be able to access resources in their own neighborhoods, housing, healthcare, rent control, investment in community-based programs, investment in farmers market community programs. Like these are the types of things to make sure that we have quote unquote public safety does not necessarily mean more police or police at all, right? We need to ensure that people are healthy, they have a space to live, eat, work, play. Like that is public safety, and police cannot do that.
When you say police at all, can you have? I remember the abolish police movement, not just defund, but abolition in some cases.
Yeah.
How would that work? I can't imagine a society without cops. That's my whole life.
I know. And that means that we cannot imagine a society without violence. And that is something that we have to build. And so, again, I read the books, you know what I'm saying? So I've been reading, Miriam Kamba and reading Ruth Wilson Gilmore. And so one of my favorite quotations from Ruth Wilson Gilmore is she says, Abolition is about presence, not absence. It's about building life-affirming institutions. Alexis Gumm says, and she asks this really provocative question that's been sticking with me, what if abolition is something that grows, right? And so I think that when it comes to public safety, we already have better than police, right? And so we deserve better than police to really create vibrant, safe cities.
Like a lot of Seattleites and people across the country, like this is something I think about a lot. I don't claim to have read the books. I don't even claim to be able to know how to read, frankly. But
I can't deal with you.
But I think where I land on this is a really immature reaction, honestly, because I do believe we rely too heavily on police for things that police shouldn't have to deal with. And I mean that as a compliment to police, like to take something off their plate, like all of the sort of defund arguments that we've heard, whether you want to call it that or something else, like some sort of major change. I'm a big bus and transit person. And the other day I had to go, downtown. I take the E line, which is, I'll say, one of the more colorful bus routes. That's kind of, I live right on it. So I take it a lot. And I see stuff that would be shocking to a lot of people, from somebody who stood up and started screaming at me and telling me that I was trying to kill him one time and, was kind of blocking my way. And there are moments where me, who is not like somebody, I don't go around being scared of poverty. I sort of see people do that. They equate like poverty or somebody having a hard time with like kind of a personal threat. And I think that's a really dangerous way of thinking. And I don't consider myself that. But there have been times where I'm like waiting for the E line to take me back home in downtown Seattle. And I'm amidst a situation that seems out of control to me in some way. And I think to myself, what is the solution to this? I don't claim to have the solution. And what I come back to, my immature reaction is, dang it, I wish I could just trust the police. And we can't. And like, and I'm not saying that, and maybe just like my terrible analogy earlier, maybe we don't try to roll back the clock and fix something that can't be fixed. But since I moved to the city in 2009, it sort of seems like the police has been dealing with inside issues that are untenable and frankly rotten. And that's the reason why they were under, you know, under the what is the decree called?
The consent decree.
Exactly. And it's like, and then you can have the argument, well, you have a few bad apples, but never, nobody ever finishes it and says, yes, those apples spoil the whole bunch. And so my, I end up just kind of having a tantrum like this, just being like, I wish I could just trust the police, because there are places where if we send out a social worker without any kind of, and I don't know, maybe I'm just, maybe I'm totally just wrong about this, and I hope I am. But when I see some of the situations that I see as I go about this city, I wonder if there was no, if there was no leverage there and just somebody who's there for outreach, would they be able to convince somebody to stop, you know, just like selling drugs openly while I'm waiting for the bus or whatever it is? I got to say, as I say that, I don't like the way it sounds. Because
I don't like it either.
No, I had a feeling you wouldn't, because them selling drugs didn't affect me at all. And I got home safely. So I should say that. And again, these, but that's just sort of where my brain sort of impotently spins around in circles as I try to balance my values and ideals with what I see around me.
Yeah, first of all, I'm from New York City. So somebody just standing up and yelling at you saying, like, you're trying to kill me. I'm like, damn, you're shocked by that? Like,
I mean, he wouldn't let me leave my seat.
I'll just say that, like, I'll just...
You wouldn't you wouldn't rather see a badge nearby if that were happening to you, Jodi Ann, than not a badge?
Absolutely not. I think the instinct that police will help you is so specifically socialized to your experience as a white man, right? When I see the police around me, I don't have that instinct. Mm-hmm. I don't be like, oh my gosh, the police are here to save me. They're going to help me in some type of way. Mm-hmm. And often when people are having mental health issues, or, you know, if you're in an interaction, I've talked about this before on KUOW, but I had an interaction with a white man and he threatened to call the police on me. And so we're in a back and forth. And if the police had showed up, then who's the aggressor here? Is it me with my little golden doodle and toilet paper underneath my arm? How am I the aggressor? But as a black woman with an afro, yeah, that could have been a dangerous situation for me. And so I think we have to get our socialization, our imaginations in check here. Let's look at some of the data. I don't have the numbers in front of me, right? But maybe, you know, Rachel does. But do police solve crime? You know, they're not really super great at solving crime. Like, do they prevent crime? Or are we dealing with a lot of just security theater? Where does crime even come from? And I think we have to look through, you know, sociologists and public health experts who can detail a little bit more about, you know, how crime happens and what we can do in a long-term, medium-term, and short-term space. Now, do I think police need to be up and out of here tomorrow? You know, that's not for me to say. I'm on my own abolitionist journey, right? I'm still reading the books, but there are people who have the data, who know how to resolve this. Are they the ones who are in charge of being able to push a lot of this forward? And the fact that the mayor is dragging his heels on making a lot of these changes, but still just shouting from the rooftops, ShotSpotter, which again is a technology that does not work, it just blows my mind.
Jodi Ann, before we take a break, what is that model, that that abolition model, if there is one, of a place that's safe without policing?
That's really putting me personally on the spot. As I said, I am on my own abolitionist journey, and so I would encourage folks to read the work of abolitionists who are really talking about just even everyday practices of abolition. Can you listen to somebody else? Do you understand their needs? Can you meet each other's needs, right? Even that community building that Seattle feels like they're great about because it's a part of our liberal values, but it's really hard to see in practice, right? Like, I think there's a lot more fundamental levels that we have to work through, which can sound a little ridiculous when we're putting this with like gun violence and property damage and theft and murder and all of these things. But are we even willing to have the conversation about abolitionism in this city?
Yeah.
And even allowing care teams to respond to mental health crises without somebody who has a gun?
Any reaction before we... I'm also chief timekeeper, so anything you want to say before we take our little break as we do?
I'll just say that I agree with a lot of what was said here. I mean, I, you know, was the deputy county executive for many years and worked in government and taking a public health approach. I've ran the county, you know, through under Dow Constantine's leadership through COVID. So I'm traumatized also by public health going through that. But like, I totally agree with that. And I also hear the trust question. And when you actually ask that question about government in general in Seattle, you know, 84% of Seattleites don't trust government to have a plan to solve a lot of the big problems. So rebuilding trust, whether it's with police or with government more generally, is really important. And I always say, you know, you shouldn't just ignore those numbers. If you want to rebuild trust, you have to acknowledge it and you have to work on it. And I totally agree with that. But for me, it's like, yes, all of that and the all of the above approach. It is that we also need officers and that we also need other strategies to use to reduce crime and keep people safe. Sometimes those are the same thing. Sometimes they're not.
We're reviewing the week gone by, and that was the head of the Chamber of Commerce, the Greater Seattle Metropolitan Chamber. We've also got author and speaker Jody Ann Bury with us, and Too Beautiful to Live's Andrew Walsh. That's a podcast, by the way, TBTL. And I'm Bill Radke, and we are going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back. We're going to hit some more news. We're going to give you a reason to smile, and we're going to hug you on the way out. Stay tuned. You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to talk about what made us smile this week. Andrew Walsh, I know that you flagged for me this New York Times story on proud landline users in a digital age.
Yeah, I thought, a couple of things struck me about it. Not to be catty right at the top, but the story begins with an anecdote from, I don't have it in front of me right now, but I believe a 60-year-old woman who lives, I believe, outside of this region, who said when there was a huge AT&T outage recently for cell phone users, yeah, that she got on her landline with a bunch of friends and laughed at the people who couldn't use their phone. I call flag on that. There's no way this person saw that headline on Twitter and then used her landline to have a party call with a bunch of other old people to talk about how cell phone users are really in deep water. But it did make me think about how, I mean, kind of a little bit like talking about, you know, the evolution of our culture based on the technology, which is always something that's interesting to me in the past and looking forward. Like, the way we communicate has changed in ways I think a lot of people don't realize just by not having a landline. And I think of a former colleague of mine who pointed out that, like, just her relationship with her wife's family was so different than it would have been in the past because, like, let's say that her mother-in-law is going to try to call her wife. Well, she's not going to accidentally pick up the landline and have a quick little, you know, 5 or 15 minute conversation. Like, we saw, and I always think about that now. Are there other ways of communicating? I mean, yeah, but now there's FaceTime, and so the grandkids can see the grandparents and stuff. I'm not making a value judgment on it, but I think it's always interesting to look at how technology fundamentally changes humans and human behavior.
When I was a kid, everybody dreaded picking up the phone when Aunt Doris would call from New Orleans 4 or 5 drinks in. They were happenstance conversations, but they weren't happy.
They were not happy?
No, I don't think it was a good serendipity.
Oh, that's a bummer. Sorry
but
to hear that.
Why do I was looking up why cell phones... I did ditch my landline long ago, and I don't like that the quality is still crappy in 2024. And so the Washington Post summed it up for me. Bits of your voice are passed from one tech middleman to another and are converted from one computer code to another until those audio chunks reassemble into the other person's ear. Some of the software used to transmit cell calls slices off chunks of your voice's frequencies and squeezes sounds through the equivalent of a narrow tube. Still, and 4G didn't help, and apparently 5G is not going to help.
See, that though, I mean, don't you think that there's always somebody complaining about landline calls as well, though? Probably there's probably some Luddites back in the day complaining about how, you know, the crunch of a telephone line doesn't quite capture the human voice. Okay.
True.
So,
okay.
You know, I don't want to be, kind of reactionary and say that, like, new technologies are necessarily bad for human interaction, but it is kind of interesting to see how we evolve around it.
Mm-hmm. I want to make time for, because I've got kind of a longer version of something that made me smile this week. So I'm going to flip this a little bit and give it to you now so that we can get through. I want to play a couple of excerpts. You heard about the, I know nothing about a cougar attack to make me smile. Okay.
What is the setup here?
Let me put that out there.
Yeah.
But did you hear of the cyclist who got jumped riding a trail near Snoqualmie?
Okay. Yeah, I believe it.
This is a little bit.
Right now, we have a bicycle on top of the cougar that we are holding him down with, but he is fighting back.
So a group of five women, all competitive cyclists, were riding together on this trail outside of Snoqualmie. They all spoke to KUOW's Morning Edition host, Angela King, about what happened with the cougar. I'm going to play a little excerpt. This is Carrie Bergere, the cyclist who was attacked.
It was crushing my face. I thought my teeth were coming loose and I was going to swallow my teeth. I could feel the bones crushing.
That's when Annie jumped in and onto the cougar.
I do remember trying to put my hand into its mouth to try to pry its jaw off of Carrie, but I felt it shifting its teeth like it wanted to try to bite me too. And so I said, no, you're not going to get the both of us.
Nor the three of them. Because as Annie's got her hands around the cougar's head, Auna is grabbing it by its hind legs, kicking and clawing.
I instructed Tish to get us some tools, like sticks or rocks, and then I instructed Erica to call 911 immediately.
And so I started to dial 911, and then I didn't have service. I had to get in and help fight at that point, and so Carrie could get away and we could all live.
We're not at the smile part yet. Okay, to be clear.
Okay, because I'm like horrified over here.
Okay, yeah. So they're gouging this cougar's eyes if they can, and grabbing its legs. One of them had a 2-inch knife, and was stabbing this mountain lion. One kept dropping a big rock on it. Eventually, the cat let up, but they didn't know who it was going to attack next, so they pinned it down with a $6,000 carbon fiber cyclocross 17-pound bicycle. And spent 45 minutes overall before Fish and Wildlife came and shot this animal to death, which they said was right after the attack, heartbreaking for these people. They're big, you know, wilderness and animal fans. The part that did make me smile was because it's just a beautiful thing. It's on our website, by the way. You should check it out at KUOW.org. But the attitude of these cyclists and friends. Let me play a little bit more.
I hope it heals up into a cool looking scar.
That's Carrie, okay, talking to Angela about how she reacted to this whole thing.
I hope it heals up into a cool looking scar. You know, it might look cool when it.
As for when she'll ride again, Carrie says she will, eventually. With her four friends, of course.
We're all going to carry a weapon because you can't kill a cougar with sticks and stones. We need something.
Well, we could carry, but maybe.
Well, you guys can. I am alive and grateful to my ladies that are now my family. My daughters didn't have to plan their mom's funeral. They didn't have to grieve the loss of their mother for the rest of their lives. You know, it's like, wow, that's what I am most grateful for.
So I don't know if I played enough of that for you to get a sense of the camaraderie and the resilience. Carrie shared photos of her wounded face, and that's all up on our website. I am not the boss of how anybody reacts to danger and violence, but I thought, well, I hope I would react the way these folks did. And that made me smile.
You mean like in this interview with Angela, or you even just mean in the moment? Because that's what I can't get my head around. If I saw a wild animal like attacking a friend of mine, I just don't know that I would have it within me to go after that animal. I feel like I'd be so terrified.
Yeah, these women were totally brave. I mean, smart. They did the right thing. And clearly very loyal to each other, which is just incredible. And maybe bringing this conversation a little bit full circle, whether they're Seattleites or folks from the region, they're optimistic and they're going to work for it. And they're actually, you know, telling that story in a way that brings hope and optimism. And I just think that that's incredible. And they're kind of a marvel. This is pretty amazing.
Right.
I mean, I would hope anyone would react this way. I think when you're in a moment of crisis, these are the moments that show you who you really are. And these women have such a strong sense of who they are and who they are to each other as a result of this experience. Every time I hear stories like this, you know, it's natural to say, okay, what would I do in this situation? And it's always this like beating thing in my mind, like, stay ready so you don't have to get ready, right? The fact that they were together, the fact that they had tools on them, you know, I'm 99% sure had I been cycling, I would not have things on me. I would not have friends with me, you know. These types of things. We're talking about landlines, right? I was looking, researching last night, like, should I get a satellite phone? Like, you know, how would I respond in an emergency? Well, do I have emergency supplies, right? Am I thinking through this ahead of time? And so I'm just so impressed and encouraged and inspired by their resourcefulness ahead of time.
Well, I think, thank you for that. I think these cyclists might have been KUOW fans, because as far as I know, it's the only interview with all five of them. So check it out, what our Morning Edition team did at KUOW.org. I'm glad I saved time, because we've got like a minute left. Does anyone have anything to report that was smile-worthy this week? Who smiled?
I have two. Can I do two?
Sure. If you're quick.
The first one, yes, I'll be quick. The first one is, you mentioned it right out of the gate, but chamber member Fred Hutch and the new blood test that will detect colon cancer. I was having dinner with some healthcare folks last night, and I'm going to get this wrong, but I think the head of UW Medicine said something like there are 7,000 people who need to be screened right now. And we think about how much easier it's going to be, how much preventative care they can get, how much that's going to help those individual lives, but also, you know, the healthcare system generally, just incredible. And we should be so proud of our hometown companies that are doing that.
Yes, I got to stop you at one, because now we got 30 seconds left. Who else?
Ellie Bay Book Company, shout out to them. They've been bringing some fantastic authors in town. I went to a reading at SPL Central this week, and it was great.
Yeah.
Baseball's back, baby.
Yeah, opening day.
Thank you to my entire panel. That's the last we heard there from the co-host of the Too Beautiful to Live podcast, Andrew Walsh, with author and speaker Jody Ann Bury, and the head of the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, President and CEO Rachel Smith. A joy to be with you. Thanks, everybody, for being Week in Review.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you to producer Kevin Kniestedt and to Bernard Wallet for running the board. And thank you for listening. Let's do it again next week.